On the morning of the 7th of October, at 6:30, something changed.
We were used to attacks, but not like this.
It's a battle. That's a rocket from a helicopter.
A lot of terrorists broke the gates and got in Israel.
And came to kill and to rape and to destroy, and they succeeded.
Wake up, people, like, it's still not over.
So they shot that open.
We shot that open, and then they came into the house.
And we have to eliminate this horrible terror.
I just want my life back.
Welcome to the broadcast. This is Michael Easley in Context. And the video you've just seen, we're going to talk in more detail about, but my special guest in studio today is Darren Tyler. Darren and I have been friends 10, 12 years now since we moved to Middle Tennessee. Darren was in the Christian music industry. He managed a bunch of bands. You might remember Jars of Clay and Vanguard and Cutlass and others. We might talk about that a bit. But the reason I wanted to talk to Darren in our developing friendship over the years, I have not met a pastor more kingdom-minded, more mission-minded, and a bigger risk-taker than Darren. We might differ here and there a little theologically, but I've never been more aligned with the guy's heart for ministry and what God is doing. He started Conduit Church, and I'll let Darren explain that name. He self-mocks from time to time, but Conduit Church in 2007, it's in the suburbs of Franklin, Tennessee, and you can't get in. There's no parking left. They've increased the number of services, and they still have the best problem you can have, turning people away. Thanks for coming to the studio, and it's a delight to spend some time with you talking about Israel and Gaza and all the craziness going on.
It's a delight to be here. It's kind of a little bit of an out-of-body because I still have conscious memories of listening to you on Moody. I traveled a lot, and especially back in the early 2000s, there was so much of the country where they would basically have two radio stations options. One was going to be NPR, and the other was Moody. And I was always
flipped a coin.
Yeah. Well, no, it was actually for me, it was like I had all this time on a bus. I remember I'd tell my bands, like, you're telling me you have no time for devotions, no time for prayer. And I'm watching you sitting in a tour bus trap for 20, you know, hours sometimes. But for me, that was where I got a lot of study done. And again, you're on, you know, I-70 going across Kansas. And Moody Bible would be on, and there'd be a Michael Easley. So it's kind of a weird out of body. I feel like I'm like when I first met you, it was hard to disconnect your voice from my ear to your face. Well, that's actually the guy, like Michael Easley, which you have informed so much of my theology over the years.
We're still working on it.
Yeah, I know. There's a couple things you're still tweaking. You're kind of like my theological chiropractor. Like you just pop it and Ooh. It hurts for a minute, but then it feels better.
I've never been called that before.
Yeah.
Well, I might have to put that on my down. Card. Yeah.
You need a life.
If we use cards anymore,
I don't.
Interesting how, you know, God puts paths together over time. And when we moved to Tennessee, you know, it was a different culture. And the artist industry, I'm still scratching my head going, how do you minister to these folks, understand these folks, the creative and so forth and so on. But you started a church and largely with a lot of creative people.
Yeah.
You and Shannon, I guess really you called it Conduit. Shannon had a little resistance to the name.
Yeah, because it's a dumb name. Do you know what I mean? Like, so I was managing rock bands by day, and the thing about going through the Word is the Word goes through you, and it changes you. And one year I was taking this pass through, and I realized how little I had cared about global mission. I would have never said that. I would have told you, oh, yeah, I'm all for the world, sure. Reaching people. But you could have looked at my checkbook and said, oh, that's not true. But for some reason that year, somewhere around 2003, I don't know, God was like racking my brain and my heart. And then he opened the door, which was just literally one church in Haiti. And we started doing that. And I think about 2005, we realized, golly, there's enough money going through here. I probably need to do something like legitimate with it, like legally. Because it was literally just me harassing my friends for money for my friend in Haiti. And I look back, some of those artists probably like blocked me because, oh, he's calling for my money again, which I probably was. But so 2005, and I'm literally, we're sitting at the table getting ready to file the paperwork. I've got an attorney here, and he's like, well, what are you going to call it? And so the only name I could come up with was Conduit, because that's what we were. We're a conduit of resources from the people.
But you got a cool logo.
Well, yeah, later on we did. I should say earlier iterations of our logo were some
culvert.
Terrible. Oh, Everybody came up with an idea. Oh, it's like PVC pipe or, you know, all these really great, terrible ideas. But yeah, the logo did turn out. But later I realized that, okay, there was more to it than just that. Jesus in John 7, you know, the rivers of living water will flow from within you. This he spoke with the Holy Spirit, which was to come. Like, that's part of our job, is to be a conduit of his will, of his spirit. And so once I explain it, people are like,
it kind of makes sense.
It makes sense. But I God only knows how many people drove by and thought that, what a dumb name. I'm going to another church.
So when the senior pastor who founded the church stands up on occasion and says, this is a dumb name, you know you're going to like him already. Well, you've also had, before we get into the topic at hand, you've also had this kind of reluctance, like a holy reluctance to be a pastor. And I've heard you say it from the pulpit as well as in private conversations.
Did you?
More terror.
Yeah. Yeah, because
went to seminary. I was trained. This is what I set my sights on doing. You have a great career, a great ministry career, and you decide to leave that and start a church, which is a very different thing.
Yeah, it is extraordinarily different. And man, I did it with such hesitation. And I think, maybe God blinded me. Mm. Like, I can remember it, our MySpace page. That's how long ago this was. The tagline was, we're not a church, we just act like one. It was all I needed to say, because I'm not a— here's what I thought. I thought if it was a church, it would ruin it. I'd been around church long enough. I'd seen enough, you know, elder meetings tearing each other apart and fighting over where this goes.
No.
So there was a holy fear and probably an unhealthy fear. But there was a moment where I was like, okay, the reason I can't figure out what to call it is that we're calling it what it's not. You know, we're not a church. We're not a Bible study. Because it was a church. It was what it was. And there was a moment where I realized that. And it was a fairly terrifying moment, because not only am I going to have to leave everything, I'm going to have to, in my own hometown. And the thing about being in the music business, first of all, it's a very small, large town.
Yep.
And everybody you say yes to, they think you're a genius. And everybody you have to say no to, they think you're an idiot. Neither are right. But, you know, you say way more no's than you say yes's in the music world. And so there was just a whole lot of people in town that knew me as this other guy who was, you know, rough around the edges, a little arrogant, actually a lot arrogant. And I know that Jesus said that a prophet is without honor in his hometown. I know I'm not a prophet, but I really understood that. It took a good decade, I think, for people to see me no longer as the rough around the edges artist manager and as a pastor. Mm-hmm. It's probably taken me that long, quite honestly, to see that. Because I've told you, I kept thinking I'm waiting for the real pastor to come and then I can get back to my life. Like, that's what I thought was happening.
You count up on 20 years?
Oh, no. We're 14.
14 years. Okay.
Although I think in church years, you multiply that by 7.
Dog years. Yeah.
Explains the—
it's correlated to the elder meetings. That's where the real aging comes in.
I'll say this, like, having worked with some of the craziest personalities on the planet in the music world, the church is harder. Like, this is hard. But that's something you've said. I remember you've said it to me and then around me that, of course, it's hard. Like, it's what it's supposed to be is hard. You know, there's a little bit of so suck it up and deal with it, as opposed to, you know, whining about it. I've definitely found myself like, man, this would be so much easier if I was managing a band. I could just drop them and get another one, you know?
That's what membership is for, right? You say, hey, we're dropping your membership, raising the dues.
Yeah, just send a little note. But
HOA fees going up.
There's sometimes like when I'd like to drop them, but then they end up dropping me, which there's those moments like, well,
Swindoll used to tell a story about wishing he could put 10 people on a bus and send them to another church. And he said, but the problem is that church was sent 10 of their people back to us. And so it's like, it's what it is. They're sheep. We're shepherds, supposedly.
Yeah.
Israel. Mm-hmm. I've been leading tours to Israel since 95, maybe, and large and small groups. We had a giant 600 and some tour we did once, never again.
600. But when you take— how many buses is that?
13 buses. When you go to the land of the book, as I like to call it, versus the Holy Land, you see where God of eternity past chose to put not only his people, but send his son, the Via Maris, the way of the sea, the only trade route through all Asia into there's so many geographic unique features of this little sliver of 3% of the landmass of the Arab nations around it. And the conflicts have always been, except of times of peace when they were well and God was protecting them. And then now in this, you know, messianic age, we might call it, where Christ has come, how Israel responded to that, the wars, the rumors of wars, and we'll talk you know, our history of the Six-Day War and so forth, where we are today with the Gaza Strip. First of all, when did you kind of get, okay, Israel is on my radar? Because you do Haiti and Rwanda and Sudan and some of these very dicey areas to travel. You seem to thrive going to danger zones. When did Israel come on your radar and why?
I think it was David Platt that says the easy places are taken, which is true. I respect my brothers and sisters who are doing missions in Guatemala because people need Jesus everywhere, right? But for whatever reason, God just kept like narrowing our tunnel of focus into to the hard places. So Israel has been on my heart for, well, you can hardly read the Bible and not have Israel on your heart, right? But I couldn't go, at least I didn't think I could, because there are countries that I go to that if I had an Israeli stamp in my passport, they won't let me in.
Yep.
And so when they started handing out those little
piece of paper.
Yeah, like little stickers from Kroger or whatever, like, hey, you get a smiley. That opened the door for me to get to go to Israel. So that was 2014, I think.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I just had it was a super last minute trip. You've hosted them, right? So somebody canceled, hey, if you can just get over here, one of those kind of things. And my wife couldn't even go with me because it was so last minute. But it went from an academic and intellectual interest to an actual real life, you know, the spiritual experience, but also because I made a bunch of friends over there, like you know, Hagir Munir, the driver, like, these are my friends now.
Yep.
And so that gave me even more interest in it. And, you know, I love the idea of bringing the gospel into, you know, God's people. Like, I know that there's, you know, they're blinded for a time, Romans 9, 10, 11. It's a great challenge, as you know, being able to minister to and to see the impact that those tours have had on, like Munir, I guess is a good example, came to faith.
And a lot of the guides, you know, they see some of the Christians not quite misbehaving and they go, these people are loving and kind and, you know.
It's everything they're taught against. You know, I have a friend that told me, he was raised in Jersey, but like we didn't hate Christians. We thought of them, like a snake. Like if you see one, you just go to the other side of the road. You know, you don't necessarily kill it or whatever. You just don't want to be near it. And it was a very confusing journey for him to what he was taught to now experience Christians in this whole other way, which is the Jesus of the Bible way.
Let's change gears. And you just got back from Israel. We were with a group of guys one Monday evening a couple weeks ago, and you said, oh, I'm going tomorrow to Israel and go over to Gaza. And we all went, death wish for? So tell us about
this.
Wasn't
the response I was thinking, by the way. Like one of them goes, are you an idiot?
Well, you should know those guys.
Come on. I know, in naivete. But
they're going to call you an idiot if they're an idiot.
Yeah. Somebody's got to.
We all are. Yeah. So anyway, so what provoked you? And then we'll get to the story.
My friends.
Over there?
Yeah. I know a lot about your childhood because I've listened to your sermons, but you know, when you grow up being bullied and being, which was kind of, I was a poor kid, I didn't have anything. So I don't much care for bullies in general. And when I was hearing from my friends, first of all, just grateful that they were alive. And then I start seeing these narratives. Israel hadn't even dropped a bomb yet in Gaza, and accusations of Israeli genocide were already starting. So two of my least favorite things in the world, right? Bullies, and the other is lies, is false information. And they're coalescing into one opportunity for me. So I thought, I need to go just to see my friends. Because if you've ever been in a tragedy or in a, just the ministry of presence, you know? And then I was able to take a camera guy with me so we could document the stories. Because these stories are real. These aren't fake. Like I wanted to see it not because I didn't believe it, but I wanted to see it because it gave A, credibility to me, but also because it's true and these stories deserve to be heard.
Now, you and I probably are on very similar planes on this whole issue that Israel has a right to defend itself, that Israel was attacked, that we've almost forgotten what happened on October 7th. But we've watched our culture, and primarily by social media and probably by a lot of funding of these efforts, not only be pro-Palestinian, but pro-Hamas. And it's a fascinating change of events, but you're far more socially connected, socially wired. And by the way, we'll have information about deeper on the show notes so people can find out more about you and listen to some of the fascinating podcasts you do. But what was it in Darren's head that said, hey, I align with Israel? Because you're more culturally wired than any pastor I know. And that's one of the things that Cindy and I so are impressed by your teaching is that you can dial in all the current cultural things and make sense of it and relate it to today and talk about the Bible at the same time going, I could never do that. So you got this hardwired part of you. So how is it you aligned with Israel and not with the noise yeah. of pro-Palestinian, they're killing children, they bombed a hospital.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to just answer with common sense, but
okay.
I know that's too glib. So if you were to just to remove the biblical lens, which I wouldn't and don't want to, but if you remove the biblical lens of Zionism and things that I do believe in, I believe that no country in the existence, no people ever in the history have ever gone out of existence and then back in a day. Like, that's never happened. So there, you can't ignore those things. But even if you did, the problem inside of Israel, one of the problems, I shouldn't just frame it as the problem, but is not just a two-state solution, is not just is Israel right, or it's a death cult called jihadism. Like, the Islamic jihadism, I've been in countries where they are murdering children, murdering women, murdering entire groups of people who have nothing to do. They don't even know a Jewish person. Mm-hmm. So it's specific to them. I swear that's why they called it Al-Aqsa Flood was the name of the attack, because they have a religious agenda, and it does have to do with wiping off the Jews from the face of the earth. But it's also wiping anybody off the face of the earth that is not Islamic. And that is not all Muslims, just like not all Christians, right, believe
the same. But if you're in that country, if you're in, you know, where the supreme leader says death to America and death to Israel, you either buy that or you're killed.
100%.
They're the theocracy, and this again is where history has failed our country. We don't understand history, but jihad and this form of, I don't even calling it extreme, it's more legitimate, it's more indexed Muslim Islam theology. They're the righteous, we're the infidel, and the goal is to destroy the infidel. Yeah. It's not to make peace.
Yeah, my friend, he goes by Cleo in North Africa. I can't pronounce his Arabic name, but we've been planting churches with him in North Africa for almost 10 years. He came out of Islam 20 years before that, and he told me something that was I'd never heard, which is the only real way out of Islam is deeper into Islam.
Wow.
And what he was getting at was, the deeper I went into Islam, the more I came to the conclusion that I have two choices. Either A, Islam is wrong, or I need to be a terrorist. Those were the only two options. You could say, hey, the Crusades were this with Christianity, but you can't use Jesus' words to justify the Crusades. They are anathema to the
right
commands of Christ. On the other hand, you can use the words of Muhammad to justify anything that's happening inside of whether it's Gaza or Sudan, which is why Islam in general, that's the logical conclusion of it. One of the things that you take the religious thing off the table and just say, their goal isn't just Israel. It is Israel, right? Al-Aqsa Flood. That is the starting point. But as is evidenced, whether it's in, you know, the Houthis in Yemen, Boko Haram in Nigeria. I mean, if you just keep going, they're all different versions of the same death cult, which is convert or be killed. And whether that was murdering Yazidis, right, back in the 2000s.
Yeah.
Or
We've
murdering.
Forgotten about that, haven't we?
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't remember the UN calling for any sort of, you know, condemnation against. So some of it, like, that's why I say common sense, because this is, you know, if you wonder what they want, they meaning whether it's Hamas, Hezbollah, you don't have to wonder. They told us. Like,
again, you're more culturally keen than I am. So what happens then? We know this. What's the noise in our country that doesn't believe that?
Do you wonder, is it Daniel 8 speaks of the coming Antichrist, whatever. He will make deception prosper is one of the things of the spirit of Antichrist. And I look at that and think, maybe that's what it is, because nothing else makes any sense to me. It's trite, but the idea of, like, queers for Palestine is the same as chickens for KFC. Like, it just doesn't make any sense. So in other words, deception. And then you look at, you know, what is it that gets clicks online? It's not about truth. It's whether it's emotion enough. The social media platforms, they prosper on deceit, not on truth. So I think some of it is that, because for the most part, and I've had a few one-on-one conversations with people that very much disagree with me. Most of them just want to yell and whatever, but they don't know. Like, for instance, if you were to ask the average protester right now, do you know that in 2007 and 2008, that Hamas was killing thousands and thousands of Palestinians who, you know, the Fatah, which is, you know, this is oversimplifying, but like their version of Republican versus Democrats would be like the Democrats win and now they're going to kill all the Republicans. Mm-hmm. Israel, IDF forces that go into Gaza and rescued over 5,000 Palestinians from Palestinians. So again, it wasn't even in that moment, right. They weren't just the Jews. It is everybody that is not going to go for their version of a caliphate. And if you're, again, think ISIS, think Hezbollah, like that's their stated goal, to take over it, which is, if you remember, the original name of ISIS was ISIL, which spoke of the Levant. Like they still call it that in the Middle East. We changed it to ISIS over here and it sort of took on. But when you use the word Levant and you look at Levant on a map, you're like, oh, that's the goal, which is this giant swath of the Middle East and then ultimately the world.
It's interesting. I've been around a little longer than you and watching what trends in evangelical, fundamental, Bible-believing kind of mindsets, you know, pray for the peace of Israel, you know, support Israel. A lot of states would have, you know, Texas and the Israeli flag or Tennessee. I mean, there was this sort of love and affection for the land. That's gone.
Yeah.
It's gone. And now, I mean, even if we look at the current prime minister who initially, it's kind of like 9/11, Bush was the hero for a day.
Yeah.
And so the same thing happens with Netanyahu is, you know, he can't form a government. And within their crazy Kenneth set of 70-some iterations, so we have two, basically three maybe, they have 70 in their government. You got to form a government. And the ultra-Orthodox and the liberals and all points in between, it's a mess. It's ironic. It's humorous in a way. But from a geopolitical structure, you scratch your head and go, there is no solution.
No, there's not. The hope of Christ is not ethereal. Like, it's it.
So why do we even try? You and I both have the same heart for our friends and brothers over there, and we wish there was peace. I mean, I think Golda Meir said it better than anyone. You know, until you love your children more than you hate the Jew, it will never stop.
Yeah.
That's as good politically as you're ever going to get.
Yeah.
And that doesn't work because the enemy never sleeps, I would say. But in my lifetime, Darren, evil seems more pronounced and more in our faces than in my 60, almost 7 years on the planet. It's unbridled.
Yeah, I feel like, so I'm 52, about to be 53, which is a weird thing to say out loud.
It only gets better.
It only gets weirder.
Better. No, it gets better.
But that has felt, in my years of this, it does feel like it's gotten darker, even to the fact, like, you know, guys, I can remember in the 80s when guys like, you know, Biden or Joe Lieberman, you know, like it was, we supported a democratic free society in the Middle East called Israel. Like that was not
it was common sense.
Yeah. It wasn't a controversial point at all. And we've gone from that to whatever this is, which is at best madness. You ask why. We have a mutual friend, Jay, that told me, it's been a long time ago, but you know, you can't bomb an ideology out of somebody. It just creates more. It is way above my pay grade to know what Israel should or shouldn't do at a government level. They have the right to defend themselves. I do know what we get to do as a church, right? The command was so clear, go and make disciples of all men and women. And what we get to do, when you see someone, especially from an Islamic faith, by the way, you always know when they're starting to get it because they get mad at you because grace is unfair. Mm. And it literally, they get angry. Like, but, you know, the idea that you didn't earn it is actually, I'm just like, that's
visceral. Mm.
And now you're getting it. Now you know what we're talking about. I asked a young lady a long time ago in North Africa, like, what would you do if it turned out that at the end of your life, there wasn't this set of scales and that you didn't have one more bad work than good work?
Yep.
And she, I mean, just like crocodile tears.
Yep.
And said, I could sleep tonight if that was true. It's not fair that she didn't know that. If you're looking for fair, it's that's what's not fair. And Jesus, he could have chosen any way, you know, whether it's literal or not, I don't know. But, you know, Revelation speaks of an angel flying around like with a bullhorn or whatever, preaching the gospel. But he chose us. And what an honor to get to do that, to get, he literally could rain leaflets, you know, himself, but he gets,
super
he chooses,
creatures,
he chooses us. And so, you know, why do we try? The answer is the gospel.
So you stepped into this, not only did you go, we want to hear a little bit more about some of the experiences you had over there, what you saw, but you've taken a bully pulpit to a new level in my book and you used conduit. I mean, you're
too much.
not enough for me. You're excoriating your people in a great way. Wake up to the culture, to truth, to what God's doing. And, you know, Darren, most pastors that I know would not do what you're doing. They wouldn't take the, I mean, I have pastors that won't even pray for Israel or talk about it. They just do the next thing. And even if you had a higher view and you were trying to be more, you know, middle of the road to say, hey, at least pray that the war stops, you know, or pray for hostages. You don't have to take a side if you're that reticent.
Yeah.
But you went all in.
One of the dumbest things that I could do as a pastor is answer a bunch of questions nobody's asking. I know for a fact that there are people in our society that are either they're asking questions or they're wondering. And so if I'm not saying it, then who is? And the answer is social media, of course. Can the sources be trusted? So if we're not saying it, it's like the worst place you can stand when you're playing tennis, because obviously you can see I'm an expert tennis. But the worst place you could be is in the middle, because that's where the ball bounces. You can't hit anything in the middle. I have empathy, maybe even pity for pastors that won't speak about truth, but I respect I'm short in that department. The truth is, if we're not doing that, let's go get jobs. Let's go home. Like I had a great career, right? I didn't need a job. I wasn't looking for anything. So if we're going to do this, if this is what God called us to do, whether or not it's popular is irrelevant. If it's the question is whether it's true, and then let the chips fall where they may.
In a different subject matter, Christopher Yuan is a great friend of mine. And the last time I talked to Christopher, we were talking about some of the LGBTQA creep and now overtaking things. And he said, we got to start with a different word. We got to start with truth.
Yeah.
And he's made an intentional shift from holy sexuality, which is his primary message, to let's talk about what's true.
Yeah.
And it set me back on my heels and went, of course it makes sense, but I'm a little slow to learn. When you went over there, what did you see that was true about what's happening on Israel and in the Gaza Strip area?
Yeah, what I saw was true. A group of people from Gaza literally broke through fences, broke down gates, killed, murdered, raped, tortured. Well over 1,000 people obviously were murdered. I just read this morning, they now believe actually 34 of the hostages are already dead. Seeing what was happening in these little villages, I don't know how else to call them other than they look like they're little farm towns.
Mm-hmm.
You know, moshavs or kibbutzes or, you know. One of the things I actually didn't know about those was that, so it's like my neighborhood, my kids are now a little bit older. They get to go live in another house in the same neighborhood where all the young people live, for instance. And so they're, you know, these are families. They know each other. And these guys were targeting anybody for that matter, but they were specifically aggressively going after, it seemed like the younger or the older, the better. There was one little strip of homes that we walked through and a young lady that had been literally murdered in her own home. They threw a tire inside of it with a can of gas in the middle of it and then threw a grenade in and just literally they said that her body had just melted. They had to, the irony of it is that she was somebody that like organized help and for Gazans. Like the other thing that's true, I have not seen reported, thousands and thousands of people from Gaza were coming in every day to Israel to work and going back.
Day,
you know, the estimates that I was reading over there is almost $500 million of their economy is from people working inside of Israel.
Well, in Israel, you have the A zones and so forth where Jews can't go, but Palestinians basically get a work permit.
Yeah.
And it's true of Jordanians too. And they come in and they work because they make more money in Israel and they take it back home. It's far better than what we have on the Mexican border with, you know, Mexican workers. And it's worked for 30 years.
Yeah. And obviously that's all gone now. There was one in particular story of a young man named Tommen who was 17. It really hit me because, you know, my son's just barely 18. These guys were going from, once they broke through the gates, once they got into the villages, they're going door to door, you know, knocking on doors. Well, eventually people aren't answering and they're either going to kick them down or... But they took Tommen, this 17-year-old, and so now he's standing outside their door screaming for help, but behind him are a couple of Hamas terrorists. So when the door is open, because of your neighbor kid, they're murdered. And then to reward Tommen for his torture, they murdered him last. I don't know who wants to call this a revolution, but murdering babies by putting them in an oven, that's not revolution. Raping women and then murdering them, that's not revolution. It's just evil. And to me, the problem, because again, the truth, they say that only 40% of Gazans support Hamas. But almost double that support what they did.
But you, yeah, and you know this as well or better than me. If you go into Gaza or any of the A areas with the munitions caches and mm-hmm. so forth in schools and hospitals and women's clinics, you either submit to
yeah.
them or you're killed.
Yeah.
You do have empathy for I do. What's happened. But at the same time, it's such a cauldron of complexity. It's like, what do you tease out first? And so the righteous indignation, mm-hmm. we're going to get rid of Hamas once and for all. Well, that means the collateral damage is going to be extraordinary.
Yeah.
Have you heard a recent count on the actual number of people that died on October 7?
I mean, the last I read, it was in the 13 to 1400 range.
And then some total 2,000 were as far as captured, killed
yeah.
hostages.
And the senselessness of it, because one of the things I hear a lot is like this tit for tat thing. So, quote unquote, only let's say 1,500 died. So why are 20,000 Palestinians right. dead? As if that's the measure of
or
success. And when you think back to the last 20 years, well, I guess I mean 20 years since Gaza's been, it's 2007, the billions of dollars that have gone into their humanitarian aid, and you'd be challenged to find proof of any of it
yep.
because it's not, none of it's above ground, it's below ground. They've spent billions of dollars on these tunnels.
Well, this is back to common sense. If you go in Israel and you go to the quarters,
yeah, yeah,
you see the difference of how money is used and what's important. And you won't find a yeah. well-maintained home or a business. You'll find a typically run-down, kind of squalid area in certain quarters. And the same happens to be true in the Palestinian areas. And you yeah. can blame it on the economic structure, but there's also a mindset.
Yeah,
I remember 10 years ago, 12 years ago, when I was in the West Bank, and one of my friends over there saying, if we let this back or over or gave to the Palestinians, it would look like that. And yeah. your jaw kind of drops. It's like going to Cuba
yeah.
or Haiti, you know, yeah. one side, and you go, oh, there's a difference. And then, of course, those on the one side say it's because they have all the money and the resources and so forth. No, if you had them, it'd be like this very quickly.
Yeah.
That's hard for the American sensibility to choke down.
I think it's hard for anybody with a secular humanist worldview especially. Maybe they couldn't begin to comprehend what a religion can do inside of someone's heart, but then how it looks in their real life. And when it comes to like what you're describing, even the most moderate Islamic places, and I say moderate very loosely, that's kind of what it looks like. That's
impoverished.
The vibe. Yeah. With, you know, with the notable exceptions of, say, Dubai,
well, sure.
Abu Dhabi, whatever. But even there, I think you know this, but, you know, we regularly rescue slaves from captivity. And every country where there are slaves right now are, so far as we've been able to find them, are all Islamic, including Dubai. Like, we just had two young girls land this morning in Africa who've been held as sex slaves for the past 2 years in Dubai. So even the most moderate Islam, the idea that all humans bear, you know, God's image, and that's a Christian idea, Judeo-Christian. Islam is not, their God is not about love. He's about justice and obedience. So the idea when Jesus says, I no longer call you servants, I call you friends. Allah no longer calls you friends, he calls you slaves. Like, that is Islam. Like, that's literally how it plays out in everyday life. There's one guarantee of salvation in Islam, and it's the only guarantee. Ours is the work of Christ. Theirs is martyrdom.
Jihad.
And I saw this in, you know, one of the, a lot of people don't know this, but one of the hijackers from 9/11 was from Morocco. He grew up in the slums. He grew up in the most abject of conditions, which meant that he was, you know, drinking and gambling, all these things that are sins. And so they will recruit oftentimes, they meaning guys like Osama, whatever, from the most abject places because those are people that have no hope of salvation at all. And this is their only hope. So they're either going to volunteer for it or like, you know, go back 40 years ago when Iran was and Iraq were a Sunni Shia war, you know, they were tying children together in ropes and they were clearing minefields with children because humans don't have, you know, God's image in Islam. You go back to Gaza, and that's why they're building these tunnels underneath hospitals. It's why they're, and I don't even know how, on a practical level, how Israel or any country can battle when you've got to, like, literally send a text message ahead of time, we're going to attack this place. So all the guys that need to be taken out are now hiding.
They're going, yeah.
And they leave behind those and literally
civilians.
Yeah, the civilians by gunpoint, they can't even leave there. So they're causing mass casualties. They literally did not dig these tunnels to keep their people safe. If they did, there'd be everybody be underground. There's room for almost everybody down there with, you know, hundreds of miles of tunnels. But in their death cult, what's true is that their life is worth the cost of overthrowing Israel, getting Al-Aqsa Mosque out of Jewish control, and then ultimately the caliphate for the rest of the world.
What hope did you see when you were over there?
The resilience of Jewish people in general
is remarkable.
Is pretty fascinating. One of my friends, Zev, he's not a follower of Jesus but we had a group of teenagers with us on our 2023 trip, and he was telling them that, you know, you guys have time getting from New Jersey. You're over there talking about gender. Like, we have real problems over here. Like, we have actual problems. We don't have time to debate, you know, that stuff. But the hope was just in that resilience. And then there's another hope that I don't even know what to say about it yet, other than I have never experienced an openness to the gospel from Jewish friends than right now, because they know they're alone. And as confusing as it is, and it is confusing, the only people that seem to be supporting them are evangelical Christians from around the world. Not just the West, I might add. Everywhere from Honduras to Uganda, like that, you know. This is not a controversial take anyplace else except for the United States. But there's an opening there that I'm hopeful that one of the things I experienced on the southern border was that a lot of the people that lived there were secular Jewish people.
Yep.
And the idea being that, well, you know, if we're just nice enough to these Hamas people that they'll be, you know, it's kind of like our President Obama. We'll just send them $400 million on a plane and they'll be nice to us. So what's happened now, they were the ones now that the very ones they were helping, it's not been widely reported, but over 5,000 civilians came over with Hamas terrorists to rape and to pillage and to loot after the initial assault. Their entire secular worldview was, if we're just nice enough to them, they'll be nice to us. And it's been completely shattered. And so now they're looking, okay, why is it that there's this guy, this pastor, and these Christian people here investing to help us rebuild our village? So they're slowly moving from being suspicious of us to being, so tell us about this communion thing. We had a guy with us that at our church a few months back. He spoke, or I interviewed him. He survived the initial attack, and he and his daughters were both like, we did baptisms that afternoon. They're like, so what do you, help me understand that. Like, you put them under the water. Like, what was that about? You know, so being able to go back to the Passover lamb and all that. Yeah, it was so great to be able to have those conversations with someone that I wouldn't say are opened, but are opening.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, and for the American who has not been to Israel or studied much of it, it's like the burned over district of all burned over districts, because so many Christian groups, tourists, you know, very loud, prominent television folks that like to use Israel for backdrops, for teaching, for fundraising, you fill in the blank. And there's a characterization of, you know, this is a tourist economy for an ideology or a philosophy or a religion, let's even call it, that works to our pocket. But these people are crazy. A lot of our friends talk about when Benny Hinn came over there and had 20,000 people come. 20,000 people on a tour.
Wait.
20,000. They rented every fold-up chair they could find in the country. They had lorry trucks setting up down the Via Della Rosa, thousands of chairs. They fly Benny in on a little small helicopter, drop him off, full television production, does his thing for 20, 30, 40 minutes, fly him to the next location while they pack up and move 20,000 people to different locations around the country. And you talk to the guides, the drivers, the men and women who live there, just shaking their heads going, it was the most remarkable, insane thing I've ever seen in my life.
It's got to be so confusing to even not know, like, the different jet streams of Christianity. Even.
Yeah, yeah. You know, well, they've seen them all.
Yeah, and yeah, because they're all over there.
One of my close friends, it's a guy that I've used many, many times, he'll ask me, do you know so-and-so? And I go, how do I answer this question?
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know that I want to ever have my name on a banner with some, you know.
Yeah.
But to your point, they've heard everything so many times, and they've had people say unfortunate things to them in the name of love and Christ. So now it's one of these fulcrums where The props are gone. They're alone. This is not going to be over. Early on, I was talking to all my intel friends over there. Oh, it's not going to last long. I said, this will be years. Oh, it can't be years. The country won't survive. And now we're hearing it's going to be years.
It's going to be years.
And so, you know, you can't get rid of all the cockroaches in a city without basically destroying the city.
Yeah.
For your take, do you have hope?
I do. And I don't necessarily have hope that it'll be over fast, but I have hope that the gospel is our only hope. And to get a chance to be a part of, you know, Matthew 24, 25, loving these brothers of mine, like that's such an honor and a privilege. And the hope is not in man. It's not in Netanyahu. It's not in right. the IDF. I think it was you that said that, you know, they need Jesus more than they even need the land. I think that Jesus is, well, I know he's wooing them, and it's hard to know where you are in the prophetic calendar and all those things. And so I hesitate to ever, you know, proffer a guess. I'm old enough to remember the late great planet Earth and all that, you know. But you do begin to see, like, this is like a tachometer. Like, it's ramping up out there. And now would be a really good time for Jesus to return. But until he does, we get to occupy until he comes. And I've got a tour on the books for 2025, and I'm holding on to it loosely. But I'll be back there again in March and, you know, with a different mission than a tour. And I love the tours, by the way. I absolutely love them. But I'm really loving this opportunity to get to, like, I've got this goal that to be the first church planted in Southern Israel. Like, we're not there yet, but that's 100% on my radar. Like, planting a church a kilometer from Gaza would be ideal for us. You know, I think that would, so whatever Jesus's will is, that's fine. You know, you can't really say you're a missionary. Like, I've had to go in, like, flying El Al is like not necessarily the most comfortable.
Different.
Or whatever.
It's different.
But, you know, they're looking at my passport stamps and, you know, they've always got questions. And telling them I'm a missionary, I've learned, is not...
You don't want to say it, yep.
That's not helpful. That's not helpful at all. But to stand in solidarity with them... Going to see my friends. And that's just, I don't know, you look at Paul's life, how many churches he planted? 14 maybe? I don't even know. And you look at the end of his life and the beginning of his life, and it's the same people. They're just his friends. Like, he served Jesus with his friends, and he died with his friends. And even he helps you understand when he was saying, yeah, I long to be there by winter, but if God wills, like, you understand it more, because I missed his friends. And so we get a chance to be friends with our people. And what do? When your friends are down, you don't abandon them. That's what cowards do. And, you know, I'm many things. I just don't ever want to be counted as a coward in this fight for truth.
Darren Tyler, pastor of Conduit Church. We'll have all the information in the show notes. You can look at his podcast called Deeper. You need to follow this guy and see what he's doing, how God's using him. Thanks, brother.
Dude, thanks for having me, man. It was an honor, a privilege. Thank you.
Did you know that In Context is fully funded by our listeners like you? If you are a regular listener, would you consider giving a one-time or perhaps monthly donation? You can give at michaelincontext.com. In Context is produced by Hannah Seymour, mixed and mastered by Sonomorphic, and music composed by Tycho and Blair Masters.